On the grid of the world, we draw our.
Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening. And don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So I want you to picture the Galapagos Islands for a second.
Oh, yeah. The finches, the tortoises.
Right, exactly. We all know the story, right? A handful of animal species arrive on this completely isolated volcanic archipelago. And because they are just totally cut off from the global superhighway of biological competition, they evolve into these wildly unique, highly specialized forms.
Yeah, the isolation breeds this wonderful, bizarre complexity.
Exactly. Now, I want you to imagine taking that exact same concept, but applying it to the invisible rules of how humans speak. Because if you map out the globe by syntax and grammar, you run into this massive paradox.
You really do. It's one of the great mysteries.
Right, because in some regions, you know, you can walk just a few miles to the next alley, and suddenly the way the neighboring community organizes their sentences is fundamentally structurally alien to your own.
Yeah, completely different rules.
But then you can travel across vast, sprawling continents like Eurasia, you know, crossing thousands of miles, and find that the underlying grammatical rules remain basically the exact same.
Which is incredibly counterintuitive when you really think about
it. Totally. It forces us to ask why. I mean, why is the invisible architecture of language so chaotic in some places and so, well, uniform in others?
And that is exactly what we're digging into today.
Right. What if the answer actually lies in our DNA? Specifically, what if the degree to which your ancient ancestors stayed put and kept to themselves versus, you know, the degree to which they migrated and mixed with new populations, what if that acts as a hidden architect for how your language is built?
I mean, the tension between the biological history of human populations and the cultural evolution of the languages they speak, it's really one of the most profound mysteries in anthropology.
It's wild to think about.
It really is. We are looking at a phenomenon where the demographic behavior of ancient communities might actually dictate the structural limits of the words coming out of our mouths today.
And to truly understand this invisible architecture, I mean, we have to recognize the people who are doing the incredibly heavy lifting to map it out.
Absolutely. The scale of this research is just massive.
Right. Today, we celebrate the work of the researchers from the University of Zurich, the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology, CNRs, and their global collaborators, who have really advanced our understanding of the deep links between population history and linguistic structures.
Yes, synthesizing global population genetics with these massive, complex linguistic databases, it's a monumental undertaking.
I can't even imagine the spreadsheets.
Oh, it's way beyond spreadsheets.
Yeah.
This team had to align completely different categories of data. I mean, wow. We are talking about taking the genetic sequencing of thousands of individuals and overlaying it onto the structural blueprints of thousands of languages.
Just to see if they both point to the same historical reality.
You say.
Which brings us to the foundation of today's deep dive. Why even look at genetics to understand grammar in the first place? I mean, human DNA and spoken words feel like they belong in completely different academic universes.
Well, they often are treated that way, sure. But they are both fundamentally historical records.
Right.
I mean, Charles Darwin himself famously assumed that if we could map the human genetic pedigree, it would perfectly overlay with the evolutionary tree of languages.
Wait, really? Darwin called that?
He did, yeah. And, you know, genetics does a phenomenal job of explaining the who and the where. It traces the physical migration paths of human beings beautifully.
Yeah, we can track exactly where populations moved.
Right. But it has always remained a massive open question whether our genetic history actually explains the underlying structures of our languages.
Because, I mean, we know that when populations meet, they borrow vocabulary, right? Like, words travel easily.
Exactly. You trade a new tool, you trade the word for it. But the deeper question is whether the structural blueprints, the grammatical bones of a language, if you will, actually morph based on human intermixing.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second, because when you use the phrase structural linguistic diversity, I want to make sure we are crystal clear. We aren't just talking about a community having 50 different words for snow, right?
No, not at all. We are looking far beneath the vocabulary layer. We are talking about the fundamental operating system of a language.
The operating system, I like that.
Yeah, and the researchers outline several concrete dimensions of this. One is basic morphosyntax, like word order.
And where the verb goes.
Exactly. Does a language demand a subject-object-verb structure, so you'd say something like, I the ball throw, or does it use subject-verb-object, like, I throw the ball?
Oh, gotcha.
Another core dimension is phonology, specifically the presence of tone. In many languages, the pitch of your voice completely alters the dictionary definition of a syllable.
Oh, right. Similar to Mandarin, where a different inflection changes the word from mother to horse.
A perfect example, yeah. And they also look at lexical semantics. There's a phenomenon called collexification.
Collexification. Okay, what is that?
It occurs when a language uses the exact same word to express two conceptually distinct things. Imagine a language using a single word to mean both finger and hand.
Or like both water and river, maybe.
Yes, exactly that. So structural diversity is really a measurement of how much variation exists across all these underlying rules within a specific geographic area.
Okay, so if you, like, parachute into a specific region, and every surrounding village uses completely different word orders, and some use tone while others are strictly flat, that region has massive structural linguistic diversity.
You've got it. And that leads directly to the core hypothesis tested in this study, the dynamic between what they call spread zones and accumulation zones.
The spread zones and accumulation zones. Okay, walk me through that.
Well, a spread zone is an area defined by high historical migration and widespread contact between different populations.
So lots of people moving around, bumping into each other.
Exactly. And the working assumption is that all this demographic mixing essentially acts as a blender. It smooths out and homogenizes the linguistic structures over time.
Meaning that as populations trade and intermarry, their grammar slowly averages out into something more uniform.
Right, which leaves the opposite side of the coin, the accumulation zone.
The Galapagos Islands of language.
Precisely. In accumulation zones, geographic or cultural isolation prevents that constant mixing with outsiders. Because these populations are left alone, their languages evolve vertically.
Vertically, meaning they just keep building on themselves.
Yeah, they accumulate unique, highly complex structural quirks over thousands of years simply because they don't have the pressure of having to accommodate foreign speakers.
So we have this very elegant theory, right? You either have the global superhighway smoothing everything out, or you have the isolated islands breeding intense diversity.
Right.
But I have to push back here. How on earth do you objectively measure that globally?
That is the big question.
I mean, you are taking the vast, messy, chaotic history of human migration and spoken language and somehow comparing it mathematically. How do you do that without just comparing apples and oranges?
Well, that is the methodological mountain the team had to climb. And their solution was really fascinating. They decided to partition the entire landmass of the Earth into a massive geodesic grid of hexagonal cells.
Wait, hexagons? You're mapping fluid, organic human culture into a giant, rigid board game.
I know.
How does that not completely distort the reality of how people actually live and move?
It sounds counterintuitive, but it is actually a brilliant statistical mechanism to standardize the data. By aggregating both the genetic data and the linguistic data into equally sized spatial units, you avoid making false assumptions.
False assumptions like what?
Like assuming you know exactly which tribal group speaks exactly which dialect at a precise GPS coordinate. The grid establishes a consistent mathematical baseline.
Okay, I think that makes sense.
And to be incredibly rigorous, they actually ran their models using two different grid sizes. They tested a grid with cells that were 500 kilometers in diameter, which approximates a realistic, broader range of ancient cultural contact.
Right.
And then they also ran a finer grid with 300 kilometer cells to capture narrower, highly localized interactions.
Ah, I see. So it's less about trapping ancient populations in imaginary boxes and more about creating like a unified pixel size so you can actually compare to very blurry, complex photographs of human history.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize it, yeah. Mm. The pixels let you see the pattern, and the data populating those pixels is monumental.
I bet. Where did they even get all that genetic data?
On the biological side, they utilize the Gelato database. This integrates genomic data from 5,737 unrelated individuals across 650 global populations.
Wow.
And inside every single one of those hexagonal cells, they calculated something called Wright's F coefficient.
Okay, let me jump in here and act as a proxy for anyone scratching their head at the term F coefficient.
Please do.
So in population genetics, this is measuring excess homozygosity. Homozygosity, meaning you're inheriting the exact same genetic variations from both of your parents, essentially because your community's gene pool is a relatively closed loop.
Yes, exactly.
Like there aren't new people bringing new genes into the village.
Right. So the higher the homozygosity, the lower the overall genetic diversity, meaning a high F coefficient serves as a direct biological fingerprint of historical isolation.
It means that population is largely kept to itself.
Exactly.
Got it. So high F equals high isolation. What about measuring the structure of the languages inside those same hexagons?
For the linguistic side, they turned to the TLI statistical dataset. They tracked 333 distinct structural features across 4,257 languages.
That is a staggering amount of languages.
It really is. And to quantify the diversity of these features within any given cell, they calculated something called normalized Shannon entropy.
Okay, Shannon entropy. What does that mean in practical terms?
In practical terms, it's a mathematical formula that essentially asks, if I pick two languages at random from this specific geographic hexagon, how unpredictable and varied will their grammatical rules be?
Okay, but here's where it gets really interesting. Because you can't just overlay the genetic isolation map on top of the linguistic diversity map and call it a day, right?
Definitely not.
Because the real world is full of noise. You have mountains, deserts, varying climates, and totally different population densities to account for.
And the researchers were acutely aware of those confounding variables. If you want to prove that genetic isolation is the actual driver of linguistic diversity, you have to strip away all the other environmental or geographical factors that might be doing the heavy lifting.
Right, otherwise you might just be proving that mountains make languages different.
Exactly. So they utilized highly sophisticated Bayesian models to account for the natural environment and local population density. They also adjusted for something called spatial autocorrelation.
Which is basically the tendency for things that are geographically close to each other to be inherently similar,
right?
Think about like property values or architectural styles. They tend to bleed over into neighboring towns regardless of who lives there.
Exactly. You have to filter that out. And you also have to factor in the grandest demographic pattern of all the out of Africa gradient.
Oh man, that part blew my mind. The serial founder effect.
It is a critical piece of the puzzle. As ancient humans migrated further and further away from our origins in Africa, genetic diversity naturally decreased with every step.
Because every time a small group splinters off to go further, they only take a fraction of the gene pool with them.
Precisely. If a model doesn't mathematically adjust for that natural planetary scale drop in genetic diversity, you risk mistaking a global migratory trend for a localized story of isolation.
That makes total sense.
The Bayesian models basically stripped all of that noise away, isolating the pure, unadulterated relationship between the genetic mixing in a cell and the linguistic diversity in that exact same cell.
Okay, so we've stripped away the mountains, the climate, the out of Africa effect. We have our clean genetic isolation map and our structural linguistic diversity map.
We do.
The million-dollar question. Once you lay them over each other, what pattern is actually left?
A highly robust, unambiguous inverse correlation.
Wow.
Yeah. The data revealed that low genetic diversity, which again means high historical isolation, is the strongest predictor of high structural linguistic diversity.
So the opposite is true too.
Yes. Conversely, high genetic diversity, which is the biological footprint of intense historical contact and migration, heavily predicts linguistic homogenization.
So the Galapagos analogy really holds up.
Yeah.
The isolated communities really do produce the most complex, fiercely unique linguistic ecosystems.
They do, and the statistics ground that reality beautifully. Moving from a grid cell that experienced massive historical intermixing, like say, coastal Tanzania, to a highly isolated cell with low genetic diversity, like coastal Yemen, corresponds to a baseline increase of roughly 2.3% in structural linguistic diversity.
Now, 2.3% might sound small to someone expecting, you know, a massive double-digit shift. Why is that number significant?
Well, when you consider the vast, chaotic forces shaping human language over thousands of years, we're talking wars, famines, empires, just random cultural drift.
Right, there's so much going on.
Exactly. So a persistent, measurable 2.3% shift driven solely by the demographic isolation of a community is massive. In fact, within their models, this genetic isolation emerged as a stronger predictor of linguistic diversity than either environmental factors or population density.
That is wild. But I want to dig into how this actually happens on the ground. Does the homogenizing effect of two populations mixing hit all parts of a language equally?
That's a great question.
I mean, if my ancient tribe starts trading and intermarrying with your ancient tribe, maybe we borrow your vocabulary for new tools, but surely we keep our own stubborn sentence structure, right?
Well, that actually touches on a long-standing debate within linguistics. The models demonstrated that this genetic contact effect touches between 15% to 21% of all the structural features they tested.
Oh, wow. So it's not just a few quirks.
No, it is not confined to one area. It impacts grammar, phonology, and the lexicon simultaneously.
So mixing populations isn't just about swapping out nouns. It fundamentally alters the load-bearing walls of the language.
Exactly. And crucially, the study showed that demographic contact impacts incredibly complex word formations just as much as simple features.
Really?
Yeah. For a long time, there was an overarching assumption in linguistics regarding something called intense morphological synthesis.
Okay, let's ground that concept. We are talking about languages in places like the Caucasus Mountains or Papua New Guinea, where a single, really dense word can encode an entire complex sentence.
Yes.
Like a word that translates to something like, he will likely continuously be doing it for us.
A perfect example. The historical assumption was that when two populations meet and try to communicate, those incredibly complex grammatical features would be quickly abandoned or, you know, dumbed down.
Right, because the logic was simple.
Right.
Adult brains struggle immensely to learn complex, alien grammatical rules as a second language. Children absorb them effortlessly, but adults trading goods need simplicity.
Exactly. Therefore, widespread contact should specifically eradicate complex morphosyntax.
Because an adult trader isn't going to spend years learning the 15 different noun cases of the neighboring valley just to swap some grain for some pottery.
That was the thought, yes. But the findings from this paper challenged that long-held assumption completely.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The data indicates that contact and isolation impact these highly complex structural features at the exact same rate as the simple ones.
No way.
It's true. The actual mechanics of how languages borrow, adapt, and simplify during periods of human intermixing are apparently much more nuanced and unpredictable than the old models suggested.
That is fascinating. Were there any regions on the map that just completely defied this global trend?
Well, not defied, but the researchers did highlight exceptional strength in the signal across North Central Asia and also South and Southeast Asia. In these specific corridors, the link between genetic isolation and linguistic diversity is incredibly pronounced.
Why those specific regions, though? What makes them hyper-responsive to this effect?
The paper theorizes it could be driven by intense cultural compartmentalization.
Cultural compartmentalization.
Basically, in certain regions, communities might actively weaponize language to create boundaries. They intentionally emphasize structural differences to socially separate themselves from neighboring groups.
Oh, wow. So even if they live geographically close, they use language as an invisible shield.
Exactly. They enforce a cultural isolation that eventually mirrors genetic isolation. However, we will need much denser, localized data to fully untangle those regional intricacies.
Okay, let's step back and look at the big picture for a moment. So what does this all actually mean?
Right.
I mean, if you trace your own family tree back to an isolated accumulation zone, does this imply your ancestors were just inherently more creative with their language than the ancestors who migrated across spread zones?
That is a very common trap people fall into when looking at diversity hotspots. But it requires a complete reframing.
Okay, how so?
It is not a matter of one population possessing a greater capacity for linguistic creativity. It is entirely a story of preservation.
Preservation.
Yes. The languages thriving in these diversity hotspots possess evolutionary histories just as long as the language is spoken in spread zones. The defining difference is that these hotspots represent the rare geographic pockets that managed to escape the massive homogenizing steamrollers of recent human history.
Steamrollers, meaning massive demographic upheavals.
Exactly. And the most profound being the transition to agriculture during the Neolithic period.
Oh, right. Farming changes everything.
Completely. When farming practices took root, it triggered unprecedented population booms and massive waves of human migration. Farmers expanded, they absorbed hunter-gatherer populations, and they effectively smoothed out the linguistic landscape over vast, vast territories.
And I imagine later empires did the same thing.
Absolutely. Later on in history, imperial conquests, state formations, and global colonial expansions executed the exact same homogenizing effect on an even larger scale.
So the accumulation zones aren't inherently more inventive. They are just the lucky places that the Neolithic steamroller missed. The mountains, the deep jungles, the isolated archipelagos.
Which makes these regions functioning time machines for linguists.
Time machines, I love that.
They really are. They offer a highly privileged, uncorrupted window into the absolute limits and flexibility of the human language faculty. By studying these accumulation zones, we can observe what human communication looked like, before the mass migrations of the agricultural revolution smoothed everything into uniform continental blocks.
We basically get to witness the full, unadulterated spectrum of what the human brain is capable of doing with syntax, grammar, and sound.
Exactly.
That is a staggering way to view language. But, you know, to be rigorous, we need to outline the boundaries of the study. What is the blind spot here?
Well, the most critical limitation to note is that the relationship between genetic isolation and linguistic diversity is correlational, not deterministic.
Right. Your DNA does not magically force your tongue to adopt a subject, object, verb, word order.
Precisely. Rather, the local demographic history, how much a population moves and settles, independently drives both the genetic mixing and the linguistic mixing in tandem.
And there has to be a blind spot regarding human culture, right? Because genetics only tracks one very specific biological type of interaction.
It is a profound blind spot. Genetic sequencing strictly captures contact that resulted in interbreeding.
Okay.
Imagine two ancient populations that traded heavily, shared technologies, and borrowed extensively from each other's languages, but they maintained strict cultural taboos against intermarrying.
The genetic data would register those two populations as completely isolated.
Exactly. The DNA entirely misses purely cultural exchanges.
DNA tells us exactly who had kids together, but it is completely deaf to who was just chatting over the fence and swapping slang.
Right, which actually makes the findings of this paper even more remarkable, if you think about it.
How so?
Well, if purely cultural exchanges were the overwhelming driver of linguistic homogenization, it would heavily blur or override the genetic signal.
Oh, I see.
The fact that the biological signal of isolation shines through so clearly, cutting through all those undocumented cultural exchanges, proves just how staggeringly powerful a forced demographic isolation really is in shaping language.
Wow. And bringing this back to the present day, there is a real-world urgency to this research, isn't there? We are currently living through an era where global language diversity is collapsing at an unprecedented, terrifying rate.
We are losing an immense amount of structural diversity every single generation, and that transforms this research from a fascinating historical curiosity into an urgent scientific roadmap.
A roadmap for linguists.
Exactly. With human linguistic diversity rapidly vanishing, this genetic map of isolation tells field researchers exactly where they need to deploy their resources right now.
It pinpoints the coordinates.
It pinpoints the precise geographic coordinates where we are statistically most likely to discover the most unique, complex, and distinct grammatical structures before they are permanently swallowed up by global homogenization.
It is essentially a treasure map. But the treasure isn't gold. It's the outer boundaries of human cognition. And the map is slowly catching fire.
That's a poignant way to put it, but yes. Ultimately, the history of human interaction is written not just in our DNA, but in the structural variety of our languages. Where populations mixed and genetic diversity flourished, languages smoothed out their differences. But where people remained isolated, human linguistic creativity accumulated into rich, diverse hotspots.
It's just incredible.
It is. What does this mean for our understanding of the original state of human language before the modern era of constant global connection?
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
On the grid of the world we draw our lines, bright screens, late nights, counting signs. Some places drift where the pathways close, and grammar blooms like a wild red rose. Less mixing in the bloodline flow, more ways to shape what we say and know. Not fate, not law, but a pattern in view. Hidden link coming through. When the crowd gets quiet, the structures ignite. A thousand small choices in the dark.